spoiler alert, the discussions in this particular podcast includes material from all five of George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire books, from Game of Thrones through A Dance with Dragons. If you haven't read those books, well, go get reading. You've got a lot to do, and then come back and listen to the podcast if you don't want to be spoiled about any of the events that might happen in those books. Thanks for listening.
Dedicated to George R. R. Martin's Song of Ice and Fire book series, you're listening to Podcast Winterfell. And now, here's your host, Matt Murdock.
Hey, welcome to Podcast Winterfell. It's another pre-recorded podcast by me in order to fill a little bit of gap in time to make sure that you're getting content continuously, because I don't have a whole lot of availability in the summertime to record. When I do, I try and record as much as I can in a big block and then present it to you sporadically in between times that I can record. Hopefully, by the time you get this podcast, we will have discussed at least one Grand Northern conspiracy, or had at least one Grand Northern conspiracy cast, and I promise you that another one will be coming at some point in the future. We've scheduled the first one for recording, I know, as of right now, as I record this, but I don't know how often we'll be able to get back to the Grand Northern Conspiracy. But I have several of these pre-recorded podcasts for you lined up so that you're continuing to get content. Oh, who is this guy and who? Why is he rambling at me? Well, my name is Matt Murdock, and I am from PodcastWinterfell.com, where you can find all back episodes of the podcast. You can find the contact links. You can find social media information, and you can find links to our podcatchers. And I always bring that up mainly because I would love for you to leave me a written review in order to, well, first of all, help the podcast stay noticeable among some great Game of Thrones and A Song of Ice and Fire podcasts, and two, because your input on what we're doing right or wrong with these episodes, especially these theory episodes, since this is kind of new territory for us, is very, very helpful. And three, if you leave a written review, it enters you into a contest to win a hardcover edition of George R. R. Martin's book, A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms. The book is going to be released on October 6th, and on that very day, we are also recording one of our readings of A Game of Thrones, one of our discussions of our read of A Game of Thrones, which is also coming up this fall. I'm going to try and parse that particular Game of Thrones podcast out for new readers and rereaders so that new readers won't be spoiled, because we have a reading for the first time edition of all of the other books. We have one for A Clash of Kings. We have one for A Storm of Swords. We have one for our Feast Dance Tandem read. Those are all first-time editions. But we realize that a lot of people have read Game of Thrones. Anybody who listened to the other ones have probably read Game of Thrones. So we want to look at things on a scope that is comparing what we know now to what we've read then, but we also want to make it easy for new readers not to be spoiled so that they'll continue to read, because there's a lot of stuff in the books that never made it to the television shows. We won't want to spoil you on book events that haven't made it into the show. At any rate, the only way that you can possibly win this book, which is A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, it is a compilation of the three Duncan Egg novellas that have come out thus far by George R. R. Martin, which are kind of set in the past of A Song of Ice and Fire, and have been referred to in the A Song of Ice and Fire series, like Sir Duncan the Tall, Aegon the Fifth, Aegon the Unlikely, as he is sometimes said, known as. Those mentions have been made in the Song of Ice and Fire series, and there's a whole separate little series of novellas that George has written about those two guys. And this, it's going to be illustrated. It's going to have like 100 or more illustrations. I don't even know how many illustrations it's going to have in it exactly, but by somebody who's done the A Song of Ice and Fire calendars before. So it's a really interesting look at the past, and you can see a lot of parallels. In fact, the first theory that we're going to discuss, because all of our theories today are about Sansa and the Hound, but the first theory that we're going to discuss today is going to be a comparison of something from one of the Duncan Egg novellas to Sansa's potential future. So we're going to look at that in a minute, but I just want to tell you, you have to leave a written review on iTunes in order to win this, or on Stitcher in order to win this. And if you've already left a review, you don't have to re-up your review. You don't have to do that. All I need for you to do is to have written a review. I've got all of the names. I'll throw them into a little hat. And on October 6th, as we read a Game of Thrones, as we do our recording of a part of our Game of Thrones discussion, I will announce that winner. And then a couple of days later, you'll get the information as to who won. And I'll probably also post on my Twitter a video of me making the drawing so that everybody knows that I'm doing it right, that I'm not cheating or anything. I wouldn't cheat anyway, but, you know, because it doesn't matter who I give it to, I still got to give away a book, right? But I'm just, I'm happy to have you as listeners, and so I want to reward you. But I need a little help from you, too. It's kind of like a little bartering exchange, you know. I'll give you two fish for one fish, and your one fish is writing me a review on iTunes or Stitcher. Man, have I gone on enough about that now? You know, I'm killing time basically because this is a pre-recorded podcast. I have to record several of them throughout the summer when I can, because my schedule in the summertime to record new episodes with other people is kind of limited. But I don't have any iTunes or Stitcher people to thank right now as I record this. And so I've gone on long enough, don't you think? As I mentioned, everything in this podcast is going to be about Sansa or the Hound. And we're going to start with some, like I mentioned, a theory that is based on a precedent set in the Duncan Egg novellas, the thing that you can win if you leave me an iTunes review. This is about Sansa's suitors. And it was posted on Reddit by Bluefoot3. Who also credits Mindset at nobodysuspectsthebutterfly.tumblr.com for this idea. So let me read the Reddit article for you. And again, I will leave links to everything that we talk about today in the show notes. Bluefoot3 starts by saying, credit to Kalua Penguin for providing the quote that got me thinking about this. In The Hedge Knight, Duncan Egg go to a tourney held at Ashford to celebrate Lord Ashford's daughter's 13th name day. Lady Ashford has 5 champions fighting on her behalf, and anyone who defeats a champion ends up replacing their opponent as a champion for Lady Ashford. In the end, the 5 champions who end up defending Lady Ashford are 1. Lionel Baratheon, 2. Leo Tyrell, 3. Tybolt Lannister, 4. Humphrey Harding, 5. Prince Velar Targaryen. Bluefoot goes on to say, when you look at the names of the champions' families and the fact that they fight for a 13-year-old maid, especially with the family name Harding, we find out they correspond strongly with Sansa's suitors in A Song of Ice and Fire. 1. Sansa first betrothed to Joffrey Baratheon. 2. Sansa then had a plan to marry Willis Tyrell. 3. Sansa's married to Tyrion Lannister. 4. Sansa's now being betrothed to Harry Harding. Bluefoot goes on to say, the fact that George R. R. Martin put Harding in that mix is what really makes me think this is a sly foreshadowing of Sansa's future husband / suitors in The Winds of Winter and beyond. But there's one suitor that we have yet to see, the Targaryen suitor, foreshadowed by Velar Targaryen in the Duncan Egg book. I think this makes a particularly strong case for Aegon VI Targaryen being the suitor for Sansa in The Winds of Winter or beyond. It would round the set out nicely and lend credence to Sansa playing a large role in Westerosi politics in the upcoming books. Why Aegon and not Jon, if you believe R plus L equals J? You might say Aegon's not really a Targaryen. He's Varys' puppet, and a Blackfyre to boot. Wouldn't this hint at Jon being Sansa's future suitor? To that, I say, For this foreshadowing, what matters are the family name of the suitor and not the actual blood of the suitor. For instance, Joffrey would be considered the Baratheon suitor, even though he's a Lannister, but he would be considered Baratheon because of his name. And thus, Aegon would be considered a Targaryen, even if he is a fake. So it works out. Additionally, Aegon is planning his invasion and will need allies. Now, one could argue that he already has the Martells because he's Aelya's son. A marriage with Arianne would not necessarily gain the allegiance of Dorne. By the Winds of Winter, he has already captured Storm's End, thus giving a stronghold in the Stormlands. John Connington mentions that the Golden Company still has friends in the Reach, which will probably make courting Margaery unnecessary. The Lannisters are on the throne, and they are Aegon's biggest enemies. They'll never be able to win the allegiance of the Westerlands, so discount them. Both Aegon and John Connington seem to have abandoned hope of Daenerys joining them soon, and have already begun plotting to conquer Westeros. Both Aegon and John Connington seem to have abandoned hope of Daenerys joining them soon, and have already begun plotting to conquer Westeros. Now, the three kingdoms Aegon still has left to win would be the North, the Riverlands, and the Vale. And guess which girl has the strongest ties to each of those kingdoms? Ding, 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 Sansa Stark, heir to Winterfell, niece of Edmure Tully, and currently betrothed to the heir of the Vale. If this foreshadowing is true, what does this mean for the Winds of Winter? It means that Harry the Heir is a stopgap solution, a true red herring if ever there was one, and will soon be killed or out of the game. It could also mean that the isolationist Vale saga should come to an end by the Winds of Winter, and the Vale will have to take sides in this war if Aegon happens to be a suitor for Sansa. It could also mean that either Littlefinger has abandoned the Vale Harding plan for Sansa and is using her to woo Aegon, or maybe Littlefinger's no longer in power and Sansa is left to meet Aegon on her own. It could also mean that the Littlefinger and Varys conflict will finally come to a head. At this point, we must assume that Aegon is being championed by Varys, while Sansa is being championed by Littlefinger. But if Aegon appears to be enamored or interested in having Sansa, you'll have to wonder if Littlefinger would just let his prized possession waltz into Varys' hands. It means that the Dornish alliance with Aegon will be a lot more complicated than we think. Arianne and Doran would definitely want Aegon to marry Arianne to cement some kind of alliance. But what if Aegon demands their allegiance by virtue that he is Arianne's cousin? If he goes after Sansa, I wonder how they will react. Here's what Bluefoot 3 thinks will probably happen. If anyone believes this is a precursor to a great romance, you'd have to take a look at all of Sansa's previous suitors. Joffrey, Tyrion, Willis, and Harry are all suitors that Sansa was basically forced into choosing, something that was completely out of her control. Moreover, none of the pairings ever seem to have a happy ending. Harry the Heir looks to be another Robert Baratheon, meaning that he has fathered bastards. So I think we can assume that Sansa isn't going to fall in love with him either. If we follow this pattern, Aegon will not likely be a suitor Sansa chooses for love, or maybe even chooses it all. Likely, this will be another political ploy Sansa will be forced to face, and none of those have had a happy ending. I think this is just more and more problems for Sansa, especially if they marry and then Dany shows up. Finally, what happened to the suitors at the tourney of Ashford in the Duncan Egg novella The Hedge Knight? We don't know what's going to happen in The Winds of Winter, but we do know what happened in The Hedge Knight. None of the five champions ended up marrying Lady Ashford. No information was given about Lady Ashford afterward. Humphrey Harding was wounded in a fight in the Trial of the Seven during the tourney and died of his wounds. and Velar Targaryen ended up dying from the Great Spring Sickness. Bluefoot goes on to say, I'd like to think this foreshadows Harry's imminent demise, perhaps by Littlefinger or another party, and Aegon Targaryen's death by Greyscale, courtesy of John Connington. He has doom written all over him anyway. As for Sansa, right now she's still left to deal with Harry. I don't think she'll marry him because Aegon will come by soon. Whether or not she marries Aegon could be up for debate. All I know is that there is no happy ending to any of these pairings. And in conclusion, Aegon and Sansa will be paired up sometime in the future, and the ending's not going to be good. There are a few edits here by Bluefoot, who says, just so you know, I don't claim to believe this theory 100%. The evidence for an Arianne-Aegon hooking up to get Dorne is convincing as well. Still, I do think an Aegon-Sansa possibility is one that we must consider, especially since it marks a showdown between Varys and Littlefinger, who champion Aegon and Sansa respectively. Here's edit 2. Apparently this observation has been made before. Here's the link. And this is the link to Mindset at nobodysuspectsthebutterfly.tumblr.com. I will post that in the show notes as well. Even if people have picked up on this detail, it's definitely fun to discuss the implications. And edit 3 is, people have been throwing around a bunch of ideas for the name of this theory. My personal favorite is the Fifth Suitor theory, as suggested by Dr. Dalen Quayce. All right, so that is the complete Reddit article as posted by Bluefoot 3 on that forum. And, you know, the parallels of history repeating itself are great. We've talked about this in prior podcasts here, that George does like to have an implication that history is repeating itself from times in the past. It's his, one of his many ways of doing some foreshadowing in this series. And I really do, I find these parallels very interesting. I could definitely see Sansa being paired up with Aegon at some point. As to the how and the why and what happens to Harold Harding or to Aegon and Sansa, I think that all you can really do is speculate, although I do like the evidence that he uses about the Great Sickness being a possibility as foreshadowing the Greyscale. There's a lot of theories out there that do take stuff from the past, and then they literally try to translate them allegorically to stuff that's happening in A Song of Ice and Fire proper. And I'm really not a big fan of that. I like that George uses things as a reference to show that history is repeating itself, but sometimes he will jerk left or right when you think he's going to go the other way. He'll zig when you think he's going to zag. So I don't particularly like doing a one-to-one kind of allegorical way to predict the future of what will happen, but I do like the parallels drawn from the past, and so I could definitely see a Sansa and Aegon pairing in the future. I wouldn't like it, because I like Sansa. I don't want to have to go through something with Harold Harding here where she's not going to do all that well with him and have another unhappy ending, despite whether it's something that happens to her or happens to him. I don't like the idea of her being with Aegon Targaryen unless he turns out to be a really good guy. And right now, by the ends of A Dance with Dragons, he just seems like a little punk, at least to me. So I'm not a big fan of the fact that what will happen or what could happen. But I do like the possibility of it happening anyway, because, you know, George likes to make us throw books across the room, right? So that is one theory regarding Sansa, and we're going to move on to another one. Now, in a prior podcast, and I can't remember which one it was, but we read a theory proposed by Runyon on Twitter about Sansa performing magic. And in that podcast, I mentioned that the folks at Reddit had pointed out another Sansa magic theory on his own post at Reddit. And so I'm not sure if I included the link to that particular theory or not. I hope I did. I haven't gone back and looked at the records. And again, this is in regards to Sansa. Everything this week is about Sansa or the Hound. And we're going to go into another possibility of Sansa performing magic. This theory can be found on Reddit as well and was submitted by Cantus or Can't Use. I don't know which way you're supposed to say that. But I'll have the link in the show notes. And Can't Use, I'll say, submits this saying at the top. This isn't a proof or an attempt at a swaying theory. It's just an artful, speculative look at Sansa and Sandor in some curious circumstances. Read it, get a chuckle, or find it interesting or laughable. It was just something that occurred to me. Sansa inadvertently used blood magic. This perhaps may have contributed to Sandor being her occasional quote-unquote rescuer and contributed to her ending up subconsciously married to him. In Sansa 4, A Clash of Kings, Sansa has her ominous dream that leads to her flowering. The passage is below. I'm honest. It's the world that's awful. Now fly away, little bird. I'm sick of you peeping at me. Wordless, she fled. She was afraid of Sandor Clegane, and yet some part of her wished that Ser Dantos had a little of the Hound's ferocity. There are gods, she told herself, and there are true knights, too. All the stories can't be lies. That night, Sansa dreamed of the riot again. The mob surged around her, shrieking, a maddened beast with a thousand faces. Everywhere she turned, she saw faces twisted into monstrous, inhuman masks. She wept and told them she had never done them hurt, but they dragged her from the horse all the same. No, she cried. No, please don't. But no one paid her any heed. She shouted for Ser Dantos, for her brothers, for her dead father, for her dead wolf, for gallant Ser Loras, who had given her a red rose once, but none of them came. She called for heroes from the songs, for Florian and Ser Ryam Redwine, and Prince Aemon the Dragon Knight, but no one heard. Women swarmed over her like weasels, pinching at her legs and kicking her in the belly, and someone hit her in the face, and she felt her teeth shatter. Then she saw a bright glimmer of steel. The knife plunged into her belly and tore and tore and tore until there was nothing left of her down there but shiny wet ribbons. He continues a little later on saying, then she remembered the bedclothes. She rushed back to the bed, stared in horror at the dark red stain and the tale it told. All she could think was that she had to get rid of it, or else they'd see. She couldn't let them see, or they'd marry her to Joffrey and make her lay with him. Snatching up her knife, Sansa hacked at the sheet, cutting out the stain. She pulled the torn sheet from the bed and the stained blanket as well. I'll have to burn them. She balled up the evidence, stuffed it in the fireplace, drenched it in oil from her bedside lamp, and lit it afire. Again, all of that from Sansa 4 in A Clash of Kings. Now, Can't Use says the spell. Note that when Sansa starts to cry for help, she cries for a long list of people, none of whom or could have come to her aid. She shouted for Ser Dantos, for her brothers, for her dead father, and her dead wolf, for gallant Ser Loras, who had given her a red rose once, but none of them came. Oddly enough, in greater desperation, she cries for fabled heroes. She called for the heroes from songs, for Florian and Ser Ryam Redwine, and Prince Aemon the Dragon Knight, but no one heard. After waking up and seeing her bloodied bed, she is terrified that it means she will have to be married to Joffrey. She wants none of that. She wants to be rescued by a true knight and not have to marry Joffrey. This is the spell, the magic outcome, that she doesn't know she's about to cast. It's important to consider that this is the only thing she had in mind when she cast her spell. I'm, of course, making the presumption that magic might work in a fashion that allows a person to wish for a certain outcome and have it happen. That seems an apt description of how Daenerys resurrected her dragons. As for the ritual, as I'm trying to show, Sansa accidentally performed some blood magic. Any attempt at true blood magic needs to observe a few ground rules, and Sansa, by coincidence, seems to have hit them all. Fire and blood. Snatching up her knife, Sansa hacked at the sheet, cutting out the stain. She pulled the torn sheet from the bed and the stained blanket as well. I'll have to burn them. She balled up the evidence, stuffed it in the fireplace, drenched it in oil. Again, that's from Sansa 4. It's quite obvious that Sansa takes her own blood and stuffs it in the fireplace. Fire and blood, the primary ingredients in almost all observed blood magic. A knife that pops out of nowhere. As much as I'm joking here, it's rather funny when you observe that the Magi seems to produce knives from hidden places or out of nowhere, meaning they weren't mentioned prior to their use. Miri Mazdoor. Miri Mazdoor chanted words in a tongue Dany did not know, and a knife appeared in her hand. Dany never saw where it came from. Maggie the Frog. She should have gone. She should have listened. She should have run away. Instead, she took the dagger Maggie offered her and ran the twisted iron blade across the ball of her thumb. And Sansa, snatching up her knife, Sansa hacked at the sheet, cutting out the stain. Where the heck has this knife been the whole time? Optional. Use blood from the awesome bloodline, like kings and stuff. Also of note is the fact that the blood of Torrhen Stark is in her veins. King's blood. Optional. Kill somebody. Going back to her desired spell, she's not trying to kill anyone or bring anyone to life, so she doesn't need to meet the only death may pay for life requirement. Seems to me she hits all the necessary requirements generally indicated for blood magic. Daenerys was an amateur at blood magic when she wanted to hatch some dragon eggs. Sansa's around the same age and only wants a little peace in her life. It's not hard to see that this is, in fact, almost reasonable sounding. Okay, so there it is. Essentially what he's saying, I guess, by inadvertently doing this spell of blood and fire with her own blood, having king's blood in it, she prevented her marriage to Joffrey. So, interesting stuff there. And like I've said in a prior podcast, there are some interesting parallels to what we know about blood magic and what happens with Sansa in terms of the stain or blood, which might be the hound's blood in, I think, Runyon's theory. But here we have her own blood, which is king's blood. So that would make for a more compelling little piece of evidence there in terms of that, if you want to go down that route. So, I don't know. Do you put any weight into this? Let me know. I think it's some interesting. I think it's fun. I think it's interesting. I don't know if we're trying to give Sansa more purpose than perhaps what she has in the books right now. I think that her ultimate purpose is to be revealed. If this is part of it, that would be great. If not, then I'm okay with that too. And that's the two theories that I have for you this week regarding Sansa, and we're going to move on to an email submission from Adam in RVA regarding Clegane Bowl. Now, because we are talking about Sansa, we also have to talk about the Hound, right? So let me preface this a little bit, this Clegane Bowl thing, by saying that many people have assumed that the identity of the gravedigger on the Quiet Isle is, in fact, the Hound. And, of course, people also suspect that Robert Strong, the newest member of the Kingsguard, is a zombified the Mountain. And thus the term Clegane Bowl has become popular because it might still represent that a possible combat between the Mountain and the Hound might still be forthcoming. As you recall, the Hound has wanted to kill his brother for some time. And I would imagine that the Mountain wouldn't care if he killed the Hound either. But at any rate, that's the premise on which this is based, that both of these characters are, in fact, still alive and have the potential to face each other in the future. And Adam in RVA's email is entitled Clegane Bowl with a Twist. Adam says, The Clegane Bowl is a well-accepted theory in the Game of Thrones fandom. Gregor, the Mountain, versus Sandor, the Hound, or Robert the Strong versus the Quiet Gravedigger. With Cersei's request for trial by combat and Jaime's denial and abduction, it seems almost natural that the unnatural Robert Strong fill the role as Cersei's champion. But how will we turn this dial up to 11? Enter the Trial of the Seven. The Trial of the Seven is a form of trial by combat an offended party can demand during trial. It is linked to the Faith of the Seven and the Andal tradition. The Andals believed that if seven champions fought on each side, the gods thus honored who would be more likely to see justice done. If a man cannot find six others to stand with him, then he is obviously guilty. In 42 AC, during the Faith Militant Uprising, Sir Damon Morrigan of the Warrior Sons challenged King Maegor to a trial of seven, to which King Maegor accepted. Sir Damon and six warrior sons fought against the king and his six champions. It was a trial in which the kingdom itself was at stake. In the end, only King Maegor was left alive. The other 13 lay dead. The last known use of this procedure was during the Ashford Tourney in the year 206 AC. It was initiated after a dispute between Prince Arian Targaryen and Sir Duncan the Tall. The Trial of Seven is rarely invoked in modern Westeros. Prior to Ashford, there had not been a Trial of the Seven in over 100 years. And Adam cites this article from the Trial of the Seven. I'll include that link in the show notes. King Maegor's Trial of the Seven was in response to him seizing the throne from his brother's eldest son, Aegon, bypassing the line of ascension. Having declared himself king and adorning a Valyrian steel crown, Maegor declared that anyone who opposed his title would die a traitor's death. The Faith Militant were chief among those opposed and captain of the Warrior's Son. Damon Morrigan took the challenge to formally oppose the king with a trial of seven. In the end, King Maegor was the only survivor, although he collapsed on the field from a head wound and went into a coma. He was nursed back to health by his lover from his exile in Pentos, Tyanna of the Tower and the future Mistress of Secrets. Despite winning the Trial of Seven and being proved innocent by the rules of the Faith of the Seven upon his recovery, Maegor mounted Beleriand and flew over the Sept of Remembrance and unleashed his dragon's fury of flames onto the base of operations for the Warrior's Son and the Faith Militant who had gathered in the masses to mourn the loss of Daemon the Devout. In the more recent Trial of the Seven, Sir Duncan the Tall was challenged by the princes Arian and Darian Targaryen during the Tourney of Ashford. The tourney itself was a high-stakes event, but after Duncan struck the Prince Arian, claiming he was defending the weak as part of his vows as a knight, Arian declared the Trial of Seven to clear his name, see the Hedge Knight. The resulting battle saw the loss of the Hand of the King and heir to the throne, Prince Baelor Targaryen, at the hands of his brother Maekar, with a wound to the head. Also, Sir Humphrey of Beesbury and later his brother-in-law, Humphrey Harding, as a result of his wounds. Arian ended up losing to Duncan after having the upper hand, yielded, and withdrew his claim, ending the Trial of the Seven. With that said, why would George R. R. Martin even include the mention of the Trial of the Seven unless it served a purpose? One could argue that it was a means to accelerate a story arc for various characters all at once, but considering most of these characters were added post-Song of Ice and Fire, why include these events unless they were to come back full circle? I believe the most important mention of the Trial of the Seven is that of Maegor and the Faith Militant. It parallels the Faith and the High Septon challenging the crown as it relates to Cersei and her sins. I believe the Duncan the Tall Trial of the Seven just serves as a nice anecdote from Duncan Egg and further confirms the ability to evoke the Trial of the Seven. The fun part is, who would fight for each side? We know the Hound must return to battle his brother, the Mountain, but who would be the other 12? Jaime in his golden hand if he should escape Lady Stoneheart, Brienne, Lancel. The Kettleblacks are sworn to Cersei, but Osni and Osred remain prisoners of the Faith of the Seven, awaiting a trial. Perhaps they choose sides as well. Let's not forget the Valonqar. And when your tears have drowned you, the Valonqar shall wrap his hands about your pale white throat and choke the life from you. If the little brother, Sandor, defeats Gregor, that would prove Cersei's guilt in a trial by combat and lead to her execution and resolution of Maggie the Frog's prophecy, perhaps at the hands of Sandor himself. I credit my friend Zach for bringing the Trial of the Seven to my attention and leading me to this path. Keep up the good work and excellent podcast. All right, Adam, thank you so much for the email and for the thoughts on that. I definitely believe that Clegane Bowl will happen because I am one of those people that does believe that the Hound is the quiet gravedigger, or the gravedigger on the quiet isle, I guess I should say. Anyway, a Trial of Seven would make it far more interesting, and I don't know if I have any more speculations as to who might be a part of it than you do, and which side people would participate on. One thing that I noted in reading these accounts of these two Trial by Sevens was that in both instances, somebody suffered a blow to the head and suffered badly. That I found that very interesting. You might see, even if there isn't a Trial Seven, you might see a similar kind of wound in terms of a Clegane Bowl. It makes perfect sense that the Faith Militant would try to find whoever they thought could take on Robert the Strong best in order to represent them in a trial by combat. Kind of difficult to find the timing of it. I do believe it will happen. The only thing that I don't like about that is that it seems like that the Hound has found peace if he is at the Quiet Isle. And I don't know if that would be so much fun to see him have to turn back to this old ragey self that we hope that he has left behind, which might make him more suitable to be a better citizen of the world, so to speak. But that's here nor there. That's more against Clegane Bowl than against your Trial of the Seven. I think that the Trial of the Seven would make something very fascinating. We'll have to see if it pans out that way. Thanks for your thoughts again. And folks, that's going to do it for this podcast, this pre-recorded podcast. Hopefully, if I am coordinating everything correctly, then you heard our first in a series of discussions about the Grand Northern Conspiracy, and we'll return there for a second one the next time you hear from us. Also, don't forget that we are going to be reading the first book, Game of Thrones, this fall, and you can find that reading schedule at podcastwinterfell.com. And we'll be recording the discussions live at TalkShoe, so you can join into the chat room while we record them as well. And on October 6th, during our recordings of those, then I will announce the winner of A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms. It's the new hardcover book, which is coming out by George R. R. Martin, which is a compilation of his three Duncan Egg novellas, which we've, the last few podcasts, we've spent a lot of time talking about. The Duncan Egg series and stuff in the past, the not so far past, but not so recent past either. So I would imagine that sometime next year we will probably work on reading A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms as well. We still have A Song of Ice and Fire that we need to go through chapter by chapter or page by page. We still have lots of stuff we can do, and hopefully Winds of Winter will be out sometime in the near future as well. So still lots of stuff ahead for this podcast. In the meantime, this is Matt Murdock saying thanks for listening, and here's Axel Foley to tell you how to contact me with any feedback you have regarding these podcasts. Take care.
You've been listening to Podcast Winterfell. Find the podcast blog at podcastwinterfell.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter, twitter.com/winterfellpod. Contact the podcast either by email, podcastwinterfell@gmail.com, or by calling the listener line, 314-669-1840.